The next argument on the panel's agenda today is Cantor G&W Nevada Holdings et al. Versus Joseph M. Asher and Brandywine Bookmaking, a Delaware Limited Liability Company, case number 74923.
May it please the court, Todd Bice on behalf of the appellants, I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for my rebuttal. As we've set forth in the briefing in this matter, there are multiple reasons why the Cantor parties are entitled to a new trial, one that was uninfected by matters that were admitted by the district court. Those errors resulted in a rather bizarre verdict, which even the district court acknowledged was bizarre, where the jury found liability against all of the counter defendants on all claims, even claims not asserted against them, and awarded more than $500,000 in attorney's fees. Any attorney's fees Mr. Asher apparently incurred above $500,000. With the limited time that I have, I'm really going to focus on two of those issues, hopefully a third if I have time, of course subject to whatever questions or direction I get from this court. The first of those is the endless, relentless interjection of unrelated regulatory infractions that started during jury selection and continued during every day of the trial in this case, with virtually every witness, culminating with the district court sustaining our objections throughout most of the trial until the last day, and then admitting over our objection a 2016 settlement between Cantor Gaming and the FinCEN, in other words, the Financial Crimes Enforcement Network. For regulatory infractions that had nothing to do with this case and had no bearing on any issues in this case. That then was punctuated by hearsay, the second issue I'd like to focus on with the time today, hearsay, particularly in the form of an email from a gaming control board agent referring to one of the central documents in this case as a scam. The witness was not on the stand. He was not subject to any cross-examination. And while the district court said it was giving a limiting instruction, it actually didn't give a limiting instruction at all because it allowed the witness, being Mr. Asher, to read it and then say, yes, the gaming agent and I agreed. This was a scam. So it was, in fact, being used to offer the truth of it. And then lastly, what I'd like to also address, time permitting, is all of this was then sort of punctuated during closing argument, including let's encourage the jury to read documents outside of evidence after the case is over, and they would see that a document, somehow proved that Mr. Asher was the one telling the truth in this case. Now we get to this case, this phase, because the district court bifurcated it at Mr. Asher's request. It was bifurcated into two phases. The first being a bench trial phase as to the enforceability and the binding effect of the partnership agreements that Mr. Asher signed. Partner agreements which he signed that were governed by Delaware law, which he subscribed to under New York law. And Mr. Asher, so we had the phase one of the trial, and the district court entered, and I know you have them there in the record, approximately 60 plus pages of findings of fact and conclusions of law, which detailed the history of how Mr. Asher got into the company, the promises he made to be given the position that he had at the company, which was head of all of the U.S. gaming enterprise, which was a new line of business for the company. They had been in the gaming business in the United Kingdom, but not in the United States. So he was given the privilege of this startup, as outlined in the district court. And for that privilege, he signed a number of documents. Two of those documents were partnership agreements. They were nearly identical partnership agreements. One for CFLP, which is Cantor Fitzgerald in New York, and the other one was for the newly formed Cantor G&W, Cantor Gaming and Wagering. Those were subscribed to under New York law by a subscription agreement where he made reps and warranties, as the district court noted, about the enforceability and the binding effect of those agreements upon him. And those agreements had partner obligations, and one of the most prominent is under Delaware law, there is a very significant provision which is somewhat unique to Delaware law, which is limited partners can agree to owe duties of loyalty to the partnership. That's one of the things that he signed on to and one of the things that he agreed to do. Ultimately, Mr. Asher was at the partnership, was at the company. He had moved out to Nevada. Again, the company had paid his way, got him licensed, got the business up and operating. He was the head of the U.S. business here in Nevada. Mr. Asher, in January, I believe it was January of 07, had a meeting with Chairman Lutnick, the chairman of Cantor Fitzgerald, where Mr. Asher pitched the idea that he should become a far greater owner in the enterprise than what he was. He was a partner, but he wanted to become a far more significant partner. Chairman Lutnick demurred to that suggestion, reminding him that that's not how the company had operated in the past and that it was still in its infancy, but that there would be plenty of money for him at the end of the day, assuming that they made it a big success. As the district court found, almost instantaneously after Mr. Asher did not get his way, he set about to go out around the partnerships and started making contact and doing things to try and acquire the race and sportsbook business for himself outside of the partners. He then ultimately resigned, and that's what led us to this dispute. So as the all of that is laid out in great detail in district court's original findings of fact and conclusions of law. So we get to the second phase of trial, and essentially, I think Mr. Asher made a decision that in light of the district court's findings, which are highly critical of him and highly critical of his actions, he was not going to prevail if there was a trial of the actual facts. So instead, we were going to have a trial about anything but that. So as the record shows, from nearly day one of this case, when we started the second phase, it was settlements with the federal government, because in 2016, Cantor Gaming had entered into a settlement with FinCEN over some money laundering regulatory problems that the company had with one of its employees who had gone rogue and had done improper things and was fired. And in fact, he was arrested. And he was the only one, by the way, affiliated with the company that was ever arrested or charged with any impropriety. But there's no question that that settlement is very, very damning of the company. Its policies weren't adequate. It didn't catch him when it should have caught him. And the company's never really disavowed that fact. But it has nothing to do with what happened in 2007 with Joe Asher. And that's the problem. And in fact, this court has said over and over again, one of the most common grounds for reversal and requirement of a new trial is when someone is allowed to interject unrelated wrongdoing into the case. And that's what happened here. And in fact, the record doesn't really do it justice how damaging it was, because the district court sustained our objections. And I don't know why the district court tolerated the endless, almost daily attempts to interject this material in front of the jury. It started a jury selection. What have you heard, if anything, about Cantor Gaming and money laundering charges? That was actually allowed. So then the district court kept this out, although we had constant wrangling and constant sidebars to the annoyance of this jury. And then on the last day, with the last witness being Mr. Asher, the district court allowed them to use that document. By the way, he had no knowledge except for just reading the document, but then he was allowed to get on the witness stand and read from the settlement agreement with the federal government. About what? Certainly nothing that had anything to do with him. He wasn't even at the company. He had left in 07. That, right there, necessitates a new trial. Because this law has been clear in Nevada, and it's clear virtually everywhere else. You are never allowed to introduce evidence of other alleged wrongs to suggest to the jury that a witness or the company has somehow acted in conformity therewith. And there's no dispute that that's why it was offered. In fact, Mr. Asher admitted it on the witness stand. He said it was evidence of Mr. Amatis, who was then CEO, it's evidence of his character about compliance with the law. And that's why it was, according to him, why it was somehow probative. Because it was probative in his mind, because he thought that in 2006, he got into an argument with Mr. Amatis about a different regulatory issue on the UK gaming side, and that somehow constituted a prior breach of the partnership agreements, and therefore he was allowed to argue that the partnership, he had been relieved of the partnership obligations. Now, The district court erred in even accepting that as a premise beyond just the impropriety of this sort of evidence, character evidence. Because Mr. Asher admitted on the witness stand, he never claimed a breach in 2006. He never claimed a breach in 2007. He, in fact, continued to accept the benefits of the partnership agreement long after the supposed argument with Mr. Amatus. And what does Delaware law provide when you do that? It is deemed to be a conclusive election to keep the contract enforceable. You are put to a choice. If you claim that it was breached, you must declare a breach. Then, just briefly, with my limited time, the email about a government agent, an official of the Gaming Control Board, being allowed to characterize in an email a document in the case, a critical document in the case, as a sham is completely prejudicial, as proven by the verdict. CF Notes' sole role in this case was that it held the promissory notes that Mr. Asher had signed. The notes he signed, by the way, after he claims he had been constructively terminated in order to get money out of my clients and never repaid them. They were allowed to use an email from a Gaming Control Board agent to suggest that that document was somehow a sham. And what does the jury do? The jury punishes CF Notes and everybody else with this ridiculous outcome.
Didn't the jury give credit against the note?
The jury
didn't find the note was a scam, so to speak. The jury said, hey, that's $65,000 that's unpaid, and credited that against the judgment.
I don't know that the jury gave credit as the note. The jury gave credit because Mr. Asher claimed this is all he was owed. So I don't know that the jury gave credit that it was that it wasn't a sham, but you can't reconcile that, Justice Stiglitz, with how is CF Notes liable for all of the underlying dispute. The facts are, my client was deprived of a fair trial by both of those errors as well as the others we've outlined in the briefing. And with that, I'd like to reserve the rest of my time.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Randall Jones, may it please the Court, Randall Jones on behalf of the respondents, Mr. Asher and Franny Weinberg Mahey. I want to start my discussion by just mentioning the irony of the situation I find myself in. I find Mr. Bice, who I know for many years, and I know to be a very good lawyer, I'm struck by the irony. Mr. Bice got up here and did what he did in his brief. He talked about the smear campaign that my client perpetrated against his clients. And the reason that's so ironic is because that's exactly what Mr. Bice did in this case, from the get-go. He essentially created a false narrative that, unfortunately, was accepted in phase one of the case. And even more unfortunately, found its way into the findings of fact and conclusions of law that were supposed to be limited to the issues of the enforceability of the partnership agreement, not the breach of the partnership agreement. So I found myself, and by the way, I want to remind
you. Well, maybe, but there's nothing on appeal from the first phase.
Oh, understood. But where that became important, Justice Hardesty, is the court's acceptance, the trial court's acceptance of that false narrative in those findings required my client. And by the way, and that's part of the record. You can look for yourselves. I counted 138 out of 162 findings, so-called factual findings, that were ad hominem attacks on my client's integrity, his character, that had nothing to do with enforceability. They had to do with alleged breach that my client was then forced to defend in the jury trial phase of the case. So I'm faced with this false narrative and think about that. I then, and think about how this works. I'm then putting up actual witnesses, and I can give you some examples. I brought some here. In the record, I believe it's Mr. Vaccaro's testimony. It's finding 118. Their findings of so-called fact. Mr. Vaccaro was just one out of the first five or six witnesses they called that I impeached those findings of so-called fact with testimony from that witness in front of the jury. So they're using, which I believe is absolutely contrary to NRS 51 point, I think it's 035, says he's essentially using the integrity of the court through those findings to support and bolster his case, something he tried to argue with what happened with Chancellor Chandler, which clearly did not happen because he was a fact witness. So it's kind of ironic when I'm standing there with a witness, their witness, who contradicts the findings of fact that have been entered by the court. That's what I was dealing with in this case. And I want to remind the court, this was a 20-day jury trial, almost a month of trial, in front of a very seasoned trial judge, one of the best, most experienced trial lawyers in the state of Nevada. To suggest that this was not a Donnybrook on both sides is just absolutely incorrect and a part of the false narrative. We supported every proposition we made, and I'm going to get to his specific issues he has addressed here in a moment. But what this really was about is about Howard Lutnick, who is a billionaire general partner, who admitted on the witness stand, it's in the record, we cited to it, that he thought that jury trial, all it was about was to tell him how much money he was entitled to. And when it turned out that that jury disagreed and said, you're not entitled to anything, then this is a guy who was used to always getting his way. And he couldn't stand the idea that the jury didn't agree with him. So what ended up happening is Mr. Lutnick was caught in misrepresentation, outright lies, in one case actually castigated the court reporter in open court when I used live note to show him to his face in front of the jury that what he just told the jury under oath was not true. And he said, oh, I didn't say that. It must have been the court reporter's fault. And then he said, oh, well, it's her birthday, which ironically it was. I don't want to say that. It's her birthday. We don't want to challenge her. So what happened is this jury heard that they did not believe or accept the repeated lies, misrepresentations, overreaching, and extreme arrogance of Mr. Lutnick, and he did not want to deal with that. And essentially what we saw here is by them successfully using the strategy of having these false findings of fact, we had no alternative but to use the real evidence in front of them. And when that happened, what happened? What would happen, of course? When the jury hears that the things in these findings of fact are not true from the very witnesses they put on, they're upset. They clearly didn't believe them. They felt they were hypocritical, and they were misrepresenting the evidence to the court.
Mr. Jones, what about the 2016 settlement? That would be extremely remote in time.
So
how
first
is that
of all,
not remote as far as bad act evidence or other wrongs?
And here's why it was not, Justice Silver. We have a situation where, and by the way, remember it went directly to and it was relevant to one of our key affirmative defenses, which was constructive termination. So Mr. Asher testified, and there were actual emails that supported this testimony, internal emails from Cantor, that Mr. Amatis, the person who was running the Cantor gaming business for that company, told my client to cook the books. It related to Nevada gaming regulations.
Isn't that propensity evidence then, and character evidence? Isn't that exactly what propensity evidence is?
Could have been. So here's what happened. My client says, I'm going to leave. And they dispute that, and they're entitled to do that. My client says he's going to leave, though, and the jury can either believe that or not. What ends up happening, and this is, remember, there was a Petrocelli hearing here at their insistence. The court had a specific hearing where we stopped the trial and had a Petrocelli hearing where he tried to determine, was there a nexus? Was there some connection temporally? And what we demonstrated, and Judge Denton accepted, and he was the guy hearing the evidence, is and this was the whole point. Mr. Amatis had a pattern and a scheme of putting profits over compliance. And as soon as they were licensed in Nevada, within weeks of them becoming licensed in 2009, because remember, before that, 2006, they weren't licensed in Nevada. So the temporal connection was he was doing it before they were licensed, and the moment they became licensed, in 2009, he started doing it again. And to suggest that somebody else was convicted Well, what Mr. Bice didn't tell you, and which was made clear to Judge Denton, was...
But isn't an overarching plan part of the common scheme? I mean, that's what you're saying. The exception exists as a common scheme or plan of propensity.
Right.
But where's the overarching plan here from the settlement, from what happened to him in 06 and 07? How does that...
Sure. The overarching plan is the man who is in charge of how this company ran, the plan of how the company would run, was that if he had a... And there was plenty of evidence of this. They were losing money. Both in 2006, when he asked Mr. Asher to cook the books, and in 2009, he was getting major heat from Mr. Lutton. You're losing money. Fix it. So what he did is he followed the same plan and scheme. Forget compliance with regulations and do whatever it takes to make sure we made money. And Mr. Amatis, what Mr. Bice did not tell you, the connection with Mr. Amatis directly, because Mr. Amatis was captain of the ship. He was the one running the show. The Nevada Gaming Commission said, we are not going to allow this company, it's a third strike, we're not going to allow this company to continue as a licensee unless Mr. Amatis is gone. That's the connection. The captain of the ship who had this, who created this whole plan and the way they did their business, going back to 2006 through 2009, and then forward, was found to be unsuitable to run this company. And that is clearly what the connection is, Mr. Asher said, and he testified to this. This guy was not changing. I could see where he was going. This is how he wanted to run the business. He was afraid and intimidated of Mr. Lutnick, and whatever it took, he was going to do it.
Mr. Jones?
Yes.
I may, if the court were to disagree with you about the saying that we didn't agree that the court got it right by admitting FinCEN, can you address prejudice?
Sure. I'd be happy to. First of all, a couple points. One is that we didn't talk about any of the criminal issues. It was a self-authenticated document, which, by the way, Mr. Amatis was bound by the terms of the agreement to acknowledge to be true. It was heavily redacted. It was mentioned extremely briefly. And based on what ended up happening in the trial, it's irrelevant. It's irrelevant because the jury found that in spite of all these things that they claim were problems, they didn't consider those because what they found is the partnership agreement said Mr. Asher was entitled to his base amount within 90 days of termination. Based upon Mr. Lutnick's sworn testimony under oath in front of the jury and in deposition as to when the breach allegedly occurred by Mr. Asher, then the unrefuted facts were that Mr. Asher was entitled to a breach, or actually I put it differently, Cantor breached the contract weeks before Mr. Asher ever allegedly did. So theoretically, all the issues that they've raised, with the exception of CF notes, which I'll address in a moment, are irrelevant to what the jury did. There was no prejudice because it didn't factor into what the jury decided. They found, based upon Mr. Lutnick, their key witness, because they wouldn't bring Mr. Amatis, who testified, that this is when the breach occurred, and based on their own document, then Cantor breached first. So how could there possibly be any prejudice to them under those circumstances?
And what about the admission of the lawyer, three lawyer letters and
sure.
The email?
Absolutely. First of all, none of those issues, I don't believe any of those are hearsay. What they do, and this is, and here's why.
You don't think that a letter with what the attorney is saying that somebody else said is not hearsay?
Oh,
because
certainly,
but it's not hearsay within hearsay.
As you point out, Justice Silver, if it was offered for the truth of the matter, we all learned that first year of law school. At least, I think I might have learned it second year, actually. But in any event, I did learn it eventually. To be hearsay, an inadmissible hearsay, it has to be offered for the truth of the matter asserted. Those documents, remember what happened here. They sued my client for breaches of fiduciary duty. And they say, and this is opening brief at 46, Cantor accused Asher of knowingly, intentionally, and purposefully engaging in fraudulent, malicious, and oppressive conduct. And that's what Judge Denton found. The man on the ground, the judge on the ground, who was hearing all of this evidence, found. We offered it to show that Mr. Asher was simply, in his mind, believing he had every right to do what he was doing. So his state of mind, which is an exception to the hearsay rule. And by the way, the judge...
But this is the attorney's statement. I mean, this is the contents is the attorney's contents.
But the content was not being offered for the truth of the matter. The content was being offered to show that my client believed through his agent that he was simply not breaching any kind of agreement. He put them on notice. And by the way, notice is another issue that is not that takes it out of the hearsay exception.
So any document where Asher supposedly had a certain state of mind, that's admissible at trial?
Not any document. It had to be depending on the circumstances. And Judge Denton reviewed that, looked at those issues. And by the way, they were highly redacted as well, most of those documents. And it also went directly to the issue of notice. So he looked at those issues. But don't think for a moment that Mr. Weiss was not arguing hearsay as hard as he could, as anybody would have done. But if there's a hearsay exception, we know it's not an issue. And that's what the judge found.
Mr. Jones, yes, I see you're running out of time. But
I am.
The unapportioned offer of judgment.
Yes. I've got this is record on appeal at Appellate's Appendix 6923. This is my comment to the jury, which picks up on exactly what you said, closing argument. I think if you actually did the loans, my calculation came out to be something like, it was just under $65,000. If what is the base amount that is due and is due and paying to me no later than June 26th or 27th, I also say, so you can't hold back the loans to deduct the claim from the base amount and then turn around and sue me for those very same loans that you've effectively already offset in calculating the base amount. So you can't do both. It's like a double dip. So you've got to do one or the other. That's exactly the point. They can't have their cake and eat it too. And as for the verdict form, by the way, it was their form that the court used. It was certainly tweaked by everybody, but it was ultimately their form. It had a clerical error. We knew, they missed it too, that CF notes should not have been in there as part of that judgment. We had no basis to sue CF notes or get a judgment against it. And we cited the case law, I can't remember if it's Wallach or exactly what case it is, but the court certainly has the ability, which Judge Denton did, to fix that without objection from us. We knew it was incorrect and we knew it had to be fixed. So, and by the way, with respect to that book, that was... They brought the issue up. I know I'm going over my time, but if you have any concerns about that, I would submit to you that is an absurd proposition that had nothing to do with the result in this case, and the court admonished the jury about that issue, as did I. So there's no evidence that that had any effect on the jury whatsoever. And by the way, hindsight, wish I hadn't done it, but they brought up the issue in their whole narrative of the case about 9/11. That's where that came from. They're trying to garner sympathy from the jury about 9/11, which we vehemently objected to. That book related to 9/11 issues that I spoke to Mr. Lutnick about on the witness stand, and he didn't want to answer them because he knew the answers. So he put that issue, his credibility related to that book, into evidence, and all I said is, there's a book out there. You saw it in front of Mr. Lutnick. You can think about that. But it certainly suggests that if that lives up to the, or meets the Leochi standard, I would submit to this court is an absurdity to try to reverse this trial after 20 days of a 10-second reference in an hour and a half plus closing argument. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Ms. Clerk, add a minute to Mr. Bice's time. I let
thank
Mr.
You,
Jones run over because it's a complex case, and so...
Let me try and go down my notes, the items that I ticked off to respond to what I hope were your questions. Justice Stiglitz, with respect to what was the prejudice, Mr. Jones responded, well, look at the verdict. It was irrelevant to what the jury did. Look at the record. He raised it every day. Every day. Because why? Because he knew it was the very poison that his client needed to interject into the front of this jury. The FinCEN settlement from 2016 has nothing to do with the issues in this case. And Mr. Jones said, well, it goes to one of our critical defenses, or our key affirmative defense. My apologies. Key affirmative defense, which was the story of prior breach. That's one of the problems here. There can be no affirmative counterclaim or defense of prior breach or breach of contract under Delaware law, because Delaware law says in 2006 when you said this happened, Mr. Asher, you had an option. You had to declare a breach or keep going with the contract, but you're not allowed to do both. And that's part of the problem here. This wasn't remotely relevant, even setting aside the impropriety of the character evidence aspect of it. His entire story is that in 2006, although he didn't leave until March of 2007, in the fall of 2006, he got into an argument with the Matus that he felt that that was a breach of the partnership obligations. But what did he do in response to that? He kept getting money from the partnerships. He took out loans from the partnerships. He took advantage of the partnership agreement. So what does Delaware law provide? Then you cannot claim prior breach. It's as simple as that. And then to come in and say that evidence and allow Mr. Asher to read the settlement agreement on the... He had no knowledge of this document, but he was allowed to read it in the presence of the jury. Why? To simply emphasize, these people were bad. Look at the stuff that they agreed to with the federal government over this money laundering problem. And what did that have to do with Joe Asher? Nothing. But what did it have to do with the case, with Joe Asher's theme? These people should not receive money. That was his theme. And that's why this argument about the book, the record will speak for itself. Mr. Jones told them, read the book after you're done and you'll see that it supports my client's version of the facts. That was not appropriate, and the district court did not correct it. The district court, in fact, compounded the error by not sustaining my objection and telling Mr. Jones, go ahead and tell him what you mean. And then, Justice Silver, responding to your questions about hearsay, this was especially egregious for us with these lawyer letters. Because you know what happened with these lawyer letters? The district court originally agreed with us that there was riddled with self-serving hearsay in these letters, and he ordered them redacted. And he only allowed them to be introduced in a redacted form with much of the hearsay out of them. Then, at Mr. Jones's constant beating on this issue, the district judge said, okay, fine, I'll unredact them. And then you know what happened? What Mr. Asher was allowed to do? He was allowed to tell the jury, see, they've unredacted these now? That they were hiding this from you. He got on the witness stand and said that. That a judicial ruling that the district court had made was us hiding evidence from them. Just like when you want to talk about the prejudice from that FinCEN settlement agreement, for as Mr. Jones says, 20 days of trial, those jurors saw us at constant sidebars every day because he was constantly trying to interject these criminal proceedings, the criminal case against Mr. Colbert, and the FinCEN settlement into the case. So this dropped like a lead balloon in that courtroom the day it was introduced, which was the last day of evidence. Now the jury knew. Look at what they have been wrangling about for the last 20 days. Look at what Cantor has been trying to, quote, hide from us. That's what happened in this case. And that's why we got a verdict that was, we're going to punish everybody on that side of the courtroom that has nothing to do with the merits of the case. And that strategy was pursued for one reason and one reason only. Because the first phase, findings of fact, it's bizarre that now judicial findings by a court are somehow a false narrative. These were the court's findings from the first phase of trial about what Mr. Asher had done. So with that, I see I'm out of time. Unless the court has questions for me, I thank you very much for your time.
All right.